We're reading Matthew 18, verses 15 through 22. If another believer sins against you, go privately and point out the offense. If the other person listens and confesses it, you have won that person back. But if you are unsuccessful, take one or two others with you and go back again, so that everything you say may be confirmed by two or three witnesses. If the person still refuses to listen, take your case to the church. Then, if he or she won't accept the church's decision, treat that person as a pagan or a corrupt tax collector. I tell you the truth, whatever you forbid on earth will be forbidden in heaven, and whatever you permit on earth will be permitted in heaven. I also tell you this, if two of you agree here on earth concerning anything you ask, my Father in heaven will do it for you. For where two or three gather together as my followers, I am there among them. Then Peter came to him and asked, Lord, how often should I forgive someone who sins against me? Seven times? No, not seven times, Jesus replied, but 70 times seven. May God add a blessing to the reading of God's word.
Sticks or stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. These are the words of a children's rhyme that exhort the children or encourage the children to believe that that words or the messages that we as people send to each other do not define us and they do not cause pain or hurt. But on the other hand, if we are honest about who we are as people, about the words we say and the messages we speak, I can tell you that words we say and the messages we send can hurt just as much as any stick or bone. They hurt in our body. They hurt in the neurochemistry of our brain, and they hurt in our soul. These sticks and stones can leave bruises and scars that sometimes last a really long time, that are very, very difficult to heal. In studying these sticks and stones and talking about these sticks and stones, over the past 5 weeks, we've been talking about a particular set of four behaviors, which we think, and some research backs up, that they are particularly harmful and hurt like sticks and stones, and they last. A researcher fellow by the name of John Gottman was studying these sticks and stones in the midst of married couples and the ways these married couples fought or had conflict with each other. And John Gottman found within a 90% efficacy ratio, it meant 90% of the time, if he found one of these, this couple was going to break apart. He couldn't say when, but he could say this couple was going to break apart. He could predict correctly 90% of the time. Now, for those of you who do researchy type stuff or have ever done behavioral research before, if you find something that's like true 90% of the time, that's not like a big find. That's not like a gold mine. That's like finding a platinum mine the size of Texas. It's like a huge, huge research find. Crazy huge. It's awesome. But he identified these four behaviors and could identify that if these four were being used in the midst of a fight, in the midst of a conflict in a married couple, that they are so bad that they would lead to termination of the relationship. He couldn't say when, but he could say it would happen. So the key for this is you do need to change and move another direction if these four behaviors are going on. If these behaviors keep on going in a systemic or cyclical pattern, they're going to cause a long-term pain and hurt, not just in a marital relationship, but any relationship. So briefly, for those who've been here the last few weeks, what's number one? Criticism. Okay, criticism. This is when you're in a fight and you go straight, that's cheating. The first one's criticism. It is when you're in a fight and you go straight for the jugular, right? Instead of dealing with the actual fight at hand, you go straight for the other person. You say, well, this wouldn't be such of a problem if you weren't too short. this wouldn't be such of a problem if you had all your hair or if you had fixed that weight problem. This wouldn't be such of a problem if you just were a nicer person. Can't you see that you're just a little bit ungracious? Criticism is the move in a fight or in a conflict to go straight for the jugular, straight for the other person. It's an attack on their person and their character. What's number two? Contempt. This is what Tony was talking about. And contempt among the four horsemen, if you isolate it and leave it alone, is the one that does the most damage. It's the number one predictor in a divorce of the four horsemen. It's the number one predictor of the termination of the ending of a relationship of some form. And contempt is to take some kind of moral high ground over the other, say, oh, well, I'm just better than you. And it is also to mock the other person, usually with body language, eye rolling, how you use the hands, or mirroring the other party in some way, in a way that's a mocking tone. Funny thing about contempt, relationships that have contempt over and over and over again weaken the participants' immune systems. It activates a physical reaction in the psychoimmunology of a person. It attacks their own sense of self, just like criticism. What's number three? Defensiveness. Okay, so defensiveness of the four horsemen, this one's the one that's the most ubiquitous. You can find it everywhere. Lots of people, almost everyone at some point in your life, heck, probably most people at some point in your life became a master at some form at defensiveness. Defensiveness is a great thing where whatever complaint comes your way, you deflect it and you point it right at someone else. It's not my problem, it's Kelly's problem. It's not my problem, it's Aaron's problem. It's not my problem, it's Eugene's problem. Like, whatever it is, whatever the problem is, it's not mine. Ideally, what you do is you redirect it in some way right back at the person who's complaining against you. It's not my problem, it's your problem. The issue with defensiveness in the long run is it means you don't take that other person seriously. They don't really matter to you, or their words or their complaints don't really matter to you that much. And after a long time, if someone's words or complaints don't matter to you that much, does that person really matter to you that much? Defensiveness in itself can be a total art form. Which makes it one of the hardest of the four horsemen to figure out how to confront. That one's the one that I think is the longest ongoing process for me. So what's number four? Stonewalling. So stonewalling, like contempt, frequently uses body language. But instead of taking a moral high ground or trying to push back the other person or attacking the other person, it's just cutting off the other person. The funny example of this is, remember Dr. Doom from the Austin Powers movies? He'd say, exhibit, 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 every time someone was saying something that he didn't want to hear. He'd just keep saying, exhibit, to them over and over and over again. And while that might seem a little funny if you remember your Austin Powers movies, there's also examples of this that aren't funny. One example is just playing the silent treatment. I'm not talking to you. Total cutoff from a relationship. This can also be used in a way of constantly just like turning your back away. This is actually frequently used in some other cultures of an emotion of shaming someone. Now, when I first ran into these four horsemen, I was in college during a research methods class, and I totally blew them off. I thought, these don't apply to me. Who cares? Only a few years later to be working on a moral inventory of myself. I was doing an inventory of my relationships, an inventory of the relationships in particular that didn't go well in some way, that I had a bad feeling inside my stomach or my soul about. There are things that I was angry about too. And in almost every one of those relationships, I found one of these four horsemen lurking, if not multiples. I found myself having contempt for another person, or at least holding on to that contempt in my heart. I found another person that I had a complaint against, and they were continually being defensive of it. And I didn't respond to that well. I wasn't gracious to that other person. These four horsemen, well, frequently by me, but also by the other person, a lot of the time both, were being used. And a lot of the relationships I felt sour about. And what's behind these four horsemen is that they're all great. They're really effective tactics of shaming another person. So let's talk about shame real quick. Shame is our, as people, we want to connect with other people. We want to have a not just a connection, but a worthiness to connect with other people. You want to have a connection where all of you is welcomed. I want that too. And shame is the act to say, well, you have a decreased value to have in this relationship. So I will have that relationship with you in a pity type of way. You cannot bring all of you into this relationship with me. It is to make an ontological statement that someone is less than in some way, that someone is just plain not good enough. That is shame. And I think many of us here, all people, regardless of tribe, where they are in the world, race, color, have experienced shame in some way. We all experience it in some way in our lives. It hurts. I feel it. I usually feel it in my stomach. It makes me want to hurl, like in the back of my mouth. And behind these four horsemen is this shame. These refined tactics of treating someone or making someone feel like they are less than, like they are not good enough. This morning, I want to share briefly a story that shows up that has some of the four horsemen in it. And is a story that takes place over a long period of my life. And it doesn't just include me, it includes my whole family. And actually a few families. You see, long ago, my parents were younger and they had two elementary school kids. I was one of them. And so they wanted to have a small group as part of their church. And so they found three other couples, each of whom were roughly the same age, and each of whom also had two kids who were also in an elementary school age-ish. I think one of them was in middle school or something like that. But we were all roughly the same age. And once a week, my family, as along with a few other families, would get together and hang out at one of these participants' house and spend time together. Us little kids, we'd roughhouse in the basement and make a ruckus. And the adults would all hang out upstairs talking together, sharing fellowship together. About a year into this a small group, though, Sherry, one of the participants, became very, very angry at another one of the moms. Her name was Renee. And Sherry began to, without ceasing, criticize and mock Renee over and over and over again. And the other parents in the group, all of them, decided to do what was the safest thing and take a step back and not say anything. They didn't do anything about this really bad relational behavior that was going on. They didn't confront Sherry on this difficult behavior. And because of that, Renee and her whole family decided it was time to leave. I was friends with her daughters at the time. And after they left, I got this strange feeling that I inherited from somewhere, that those daughters just weren't quite cool enough to hang out with me anyway. So anyway, it was all fine. It didn't matter to me that much. They weren't quite cool enough. And those daughters, who were once my friends, over years became more and more and more distant and estranged to me. For the sins of the mothers and the fathers was inherited to the sons and to the daughters. It was 9 years, for another 9 years, everything went great. Some of the other boys in this small group became some of my closest friends in my adolescence. They were so dear to me. And in the same way, the parents all grew to be in close relationship with one another, usually hanging out or having a cool event once or twice a month, going to see the movies all together as a couple of families. It was great. And one time, all the parents decided to go away on a trip together. I think it was for a 3-day weekend. And on the last day of the trip, Sherry and my mother had a miscommunication. And Sherry didn't like this miscommunication very much, so she responded and chose to continually stonewall my mother. Over and over and over again. Gave her the silent treatment for an entire day while they were like traveling home together. Once they got home, my mom wanted to try and reach out to figure out some form of reconciliation. They came to the whole, all the parents came together for another get-together party type thing. And that time, Sherry, every time my mom walked into the room, actively turned her back away and refused to acknowledge her. This is the act in some cultures of continually shaming someone, of saying that you are not worthy of being even recognized by me, recognized as a person. For our family, it got really, really confusing. We didn't know what was going on. Even though I was an adolescent, I couldn't wrap my head around all the dynamics that were going on between these two mothers. One of them was my friend, and one of them was my very own mother. And it was hard for me to figure out what was going on. I even told Mom, you know, the Bible says you have to go work it out between each other. But when my mom finally got the opportunity to approach Sherry in reconciliation, Sherry said, yes, I will accept reconciliation with you. You have to say you did everything wrong, that I am better than you. You never should have questioned me, and you were wrong to even think that you could question me. Not far off, Todd. These are words of utter contempt for another person, but they're also words of an ultimatum of utter power over a person. There's a word for this that appears in the New Testament. The word is athutain. It appears in 2 Timothy chapter 2:17, I believe. No, it's 1 Timothy 2:17. It's in this passage that's so frequently quoted about, and I do not permit women to athutain over men. This is Paul saying that he does not allow women to have domineering and absolute controlling control over men. In fact, the New Testament as a whole doesn't suggest that anyone should athutain over another. It does not suggest that anyone should have domineering and absolute controlling authority over another person. The New Testament simply does not accept that as a plausibility for creating healthy relationship. Matthew 18 makes a very, very subtle distinction in itself that's frequently overlooked. Matthew 18 makes the assumption that both of these parties that are involved, both the accuser and the accusing of sin, both of them are on an equal playing field. They are in equal relationship with one another. They are in a relationship of grace with one another. They aren't trying to rule over each other or trying to get dominance over each other. When we try and get dominance over each other in any way, when we try and shame each other, we cause destructions to our relationships. And not only that, we don't cause destruction to just that one relationship. Especially if you use your four horsemen right, you can cause damage to a whole network of relationships. Maybe even damage to a whole family or a whole set of families or a whole community. When we engage in this behavior, this can have a snowball effect, right? A snowball effect that hurts. And so my mom and my dad left this small group, and they were very, very hurt and vulnerable. They didn't know what to do. At that same time, it didn't happen immediately, but that started the cracks in my relationships with some of my other friends. That because of that, we haven't figured out how to reconcile. And it didn't happen immediately, and it didn't happen in the same way, but it did finally happen. So when my parents were in this very hurt, very vulnerable state, especially my mom, she did something very brave and very courageous. She turned to Renee, to that couple that had been cast outside, that had been ostracized so long ago. And she said, "I have sinned against you. I have done wrong. I stood idly by while I watched someone berate and attack you, and I shouldn't have done that. And I was wrong." And Renee, who had been carrying around this hurt for 9 years, not exactly knowing what to do with it, did something brave and courageous and welcomed my mother with open arms. Quickly, I found that those daughters that were so estranged from me that I thought were a little weird weren't really weird at all. They were awesome. And they, to this day, are some of my closest friends. For the restoration and the reconciliation of the mothers and the fathers is passed down to the sons and to the daughters. When we make reconciliation with others whom we've wronged or have wronged us, we can bring healing to more than just one relationship. We can bring healing. We have the power sometimes to bring healing to many relationships. And that's part of the beauty of reconciling when stuff isn't going right. I think I've had a long time to think a bit about this story, to think about what it means for me, what it means for my relationships, what it means for my family. And what it means, I think, to be here as a church today. First, one thing that I figured out that was a hard lesson to figure out from this story is you don't know what kind of love you share with friends until you kind of have some conflict with them, until you hit a bump in the road. And that bump in the road can tell you a lot about what kind of relationship you have or what kind of relationship you want to work on. If you hit that little tiniest bump and people say, "Sayonara," does that sound like a loving relationship to you? Perhaps it had loving feelings. Maybe you had great things in common and great laughs. But I don't think that is the love of Jesus. See, the love of Jesus is a committed love. It's a covenantal love. It's a love that chases after those, even those who aren't active in reconciliation with God. It is the love that is always calling. It says, "Come, make amends with me. For I am here. We can be one together. We can be in common unity." It's this love of Jesus that also strikes to me a lot like the grace of God. Such grace is the opposite of shame. Such grace does not say, "Oh, you aren't good enough to be in relationship to me. No, no, no. Who told you that?" This grace is an open hand. It is open arms of love that say, "Come, be in relationship with me. Whatever has come, we can figure it out together. We can figure it out. I'm not leaving you here in the dust." These open hands, these open arms of love, of grace, embrace all of a person, not just parts of a person, all of them, even the parts that you yourself might not like very much. Over the next few weeks here at Grace, we're going to start talking about what is our vision for who we are called to be as a church. What are some of our core values that we want to see going on here on a Sunday morning, here in life groups or whatever event we have going on, but here in like our lives, what kind of fruit do we want to be building in our lives together? And what kind of fruit can we bear for the kingdom of God? For a kingdom of restoration and reconciliation. And I would say to you that much of that core values are a lie in the first word of our name. Tell me this, are we shame Christian fellowship? Tell me this, are we criticism Christian fellowship? Okay, I should be starting to offend some of you guys right about now, right? Is our name defensiveness or contempt Christian fellowship? Or is it stonewalling Christian fellowship? Do people come here so we can stonewall each other? These behaviors describe the very antithetical nature of who we think God has called us to be. God has called us to be open arms of love to whoever comes through the door. No matter what kind or creed, we might have an issue with tongues. We'll have to work that one out a little bit, but we will work it out. If someone comes in here and they're speaking Swahili, I'm going to have to take a couple of lessons. Or if someone comes in here taking Portuguese, I might ask you to figure that one out. But we will do what we can to embrace that person with grace. To the best we can with the same grace as God's grace. And here at a church, we are a culture together. We are called to be one culture of God's people who are molded by God's grace. And whoever we meet in our relationships, in the tough situations of life, we are called to open up with that grace. And that grace is completely, completely the opposite of anything these four horsemen stand for. And that's one of the reasons why it's really important for us to know about these four horsemen. And not just know them, but be able to spot them sometimes. When your brother or sister is doing this to somebody, even if it's on Facebook, you should say, you know, that sounds a little bit like contempt right there. Are you sure you're not doing that? Boy, that's a tough conversation. Please don't jump to criticizing them and to making bad statements about them. I know that you're frustrated with this, but cutting off that person or ignoring them, I don't know if that's going to solve the problem right now. Aren't we supposed to figure out how to embrace each other? And when there is conflict among us, which there often is, when there's sticks and stones laying about, how should we deal with that? I believe we should be committed to trying to figure it out. As a believer of Jesus, someone who's been like zapped by God's power of love and reconciliation, I always want to see reconciliation. I always want to see restoration in relationships. Now, fortunately, sometimes that doesn't always work out. Sometimes there is such a thing where that's not on the table. But it hurts my heart. It hurts my soul. I want to see some attempt at some kind of restoration or reconciliation between people. Finally, I think if we are serious about this covenantal love, if we are serious about this grace of God and turning away from these four horsemen, this leads us into a place of recognizing the violence that is around us in the world. Through the shame and evil and angry messages that burn, that sting, that leave bruises like those sticks and like those stones. And I believe we are called to be peacemakers. Not just people who sit idly by to watch this conflict happen, but to get in the midst of it and say, this is not who God has called this community to be. This is not the way we are to relate to one another. I'll tell you, this peacemaking has not always led me into the safest of circumstances. It's sometimes led me into some slightly bloody circumstances. I've always known that God was by my side. And in the midst of things going wrong, frequently I hear the word of the Lord in my ear. Despite what they're saying, Evan, I love you. And I have love for these people. I have love for these people. I have grace for these people. This isn't their way. And in that moment, sometimes I am immune to those sticks and stones, quite amazingly, even when they're directed at me. This morning I want us to take seriously the call to be peacemakers in our culture, to be a people of covenantal love, both out there, out in the world, out in our communities and our networks of people, but also when we're here together not just on Sunday mornings, but any Grace Christian Fellowship pseudo two or three people have gotten together, therefore Jesus is there type situation as well. When two of you go out to lunch, that you would embrace each other with grace and covenantal love. This morning, as I get ready for just a quick application, could you come get Sarah real quick? Yeah. Oh, Mark, can you get Sarah? Okay, so we're going to do an ancient Christian, that's not ancient, it's about a 500-year-old Christian tradition, one that you have probably done many times before and not known the actual meaning of. It is called passing the peace. And it is to, if you are in peace with everyone in this congregation, to go unto others and to wish them with the fullness of your heart and with a complete prayer, the Irenu Christu, the peace of Christ, the shalom of God, the peace of the Lord would be with them. And I ask that you would go around for simply a few minutes and wish someone from the bottom of your heart, not just with a smile, but with the bottom of your heart, the peace of the Lord.